if your telephone is still on, please do expect the death penalty. Secondly, we have on Tuesday, which by my calculation is tomorrow, a Cameron Dweck, who's coming to speak about his exciting Northwest Passage expedition. He has a daytime job at the Financial Times, but he has a rather more interesting topic as a yachtsman. On Thursday, we have a good punch-up at the FCC, which is a debate between David Webb and Jake Vanderkamp on this blackout period for company directors, which is going nowhere. And the following Monday, which is March the 30th, we have one of the, I would say, better-known China economy specialists, Yasheng Huang, who will be talking about the global economy, China's challenges in the global economy. And lastly, for the immediate future, on Monday the 6th of April, we have Sundaram Tagore, who is of the gallery of the same name, talking about the promise of modernism in Indian art over the last century. You can't think of a rather more impressive subject than that. But today, we're very pleased to welcome Albert Ho, who I think to anyone who's covered Hong Kong politics in at least two or three decades needs very little introduction. He is, of course, among other things, the chairman of the Democratic Party, but he's here primarily in his capacity as the chairman of the China Human Rights Lawyers Concern Group. And he is somebody who has a very long association with the human rights movement in China and obviously the civil rights movement here in Hong Kong itself. And he's talking today about the Charter 08, which I have to say, as someone who's covered this slightly, I'm amazed has received so little coverage in the international media, considering its enormous significance and the impact that it's starting to have in China as one of those what you might call slow boiler movements that will, I think, become in historical context very significant indeed. But the person who knows much more about this than I do is Albert Ho, so please welcome Albert Ho.
Thank you very much, Stephen, for your kind introduction. Ladies and gentlemen, I must confess that I am a little bit disappointed when I arrived here and heard that that the club did not receive any call from the Chinese ministry for a stop of this luncheon talk today. As a matter of fact, I've arranged my personal assistant to bring a loudspeaker so that if necessary, I can stand outside and speak through the loudspeaker. Now, since this talk is now an uneventful occasion, then I would be able to maintain your interest in the topic. For the benefit of those who may not be familiar with the Charter 08 incident, maybe I will start by giving you a little bit background. This Charter 08 is a public written document that was co-signed by 303 public intellectuals in mainland China and formally released on the internet on the 9th of December last year. That is on the eve of the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, this event is one of the most significant landmark events in the civil rights movement in the last two decades in mainland China. The document, after it is released, has received enormous support. And up to now, to my understanding, there are already over 10,000 people in mainland China, who have put their signatures you know, on the charter, showing the support to it. And there are thousands of people overseas, including Hong Kong, Taiwan, you know, and many other countries, where people have also, you know, given their support to the charter. Now, the charter contains a declaration of aspiration of the Chinese people for democracy, freedom, equality, rule of law, constitutionalism. All these are, of course, universal values enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And all the more, in the preamble of the Charter, the authors expressly mention that China had also initialed on the International Covenant on Political and Civil Rights 10 years, namely in 1998, signifying that China also, as a nation, accepts these values. Although, up to date, the National People's Congress have not yet ratified the covenant, and hence had not yet implemented. But still, you know, there's no argument that this is not something alien to China. This is not something that entirely belongs to the West. It's something that is universal. That is something that should be supported by every nation members of the United Nations organizations and should be accepted, endorsed, and put into practice by all the signatories to the covenant. Now, to enable you to have a feel of the passion of the authors of the charter, now I would like to read to you a certain small extract from it. Now, here's the from the preamble. By departing from these values, I quote, departing from these values, which values means the values enshrined in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Now, the author goes on to say, the Chinese government's approach to modernization has proven disastrous. It has stripped people of their rights, destroyed their dignity, and corrupted normal human intercourse. So we ask, where is China heading in the 21st century? Will it continue with modernization under authoritarian rule, or will it embrace universal values, join the mainstream of civilized nations, and build a democratic system? There is no avoiding to these questions. So this is a very provocative question asked by the authors. And then the author went on to say, in 1998, the Chinese government signed two important international human rights conventions. In 2004, it amended its constitution to include the phrase respect and protect human rights. And this year, in 2008, it has promised to promote a national human rights action plan. Unfortunately, most of this political progress has extended no further than the paper on which it is written. Then, you know, the authors went on to say very rhetorically, listen now, the political reality, which is plain for everyone to see, is that China has many laws, but no rule of law. It has a constitution, but no constitutional government. The ruling elite continues to cling to its authoritarian power and fights off any move toward political change. And then the stultifying results are endemic official corruption and undermining of the rule of law, weak human rights, decay in public ethics, crony capitalism, growing inequality between the wealthy and the poor, pillage of the natural environment as well as the human and historical environments, and the exacerbation of a long list of social conflicts, especially in recent times, a sharpening animosity between officials and ordinary people. Now then, you know, they just went on to spell out the fundamental principles they believe in, namely freedom, human rights, equality, democracy, constitutional rule, and they spell out certain strategy for achieving these aims. Now, all these are, you know, well known to, you know, are very common, you know, to people who are, you know, familiar with the democracy in the Western world. So all these are, you know, something that is not very new, you know, even to intellectuals in mainland China. But I think it's the act itself that is significant. It immediately caused a nervous shock to the Chinese government. They took it as a challenge to the authority of the Chinese Communist Party. And they could not stand it. So immediately, actually one day before the release of this document, the prime mover of this action, Liu Xiaobo, who is of course a well-known leading writer in China, was arrested, he was detained. Subsequently, he was threatened to be prosecuted for inciting to subvert the state government. Now he is put on residential surveillance for 6 months since he was since his arrest. And there were a number of other very famous intellectuals, comprising scholars and professors in universities, prominent human rights lawyers and writers, etc. 303 of them. Now, but surprisingly, you know, many of them who were taken by the police for interrogation, although they were subjected to certain some sort of intimidation or harassment, but none of them were prosecuted. Very surprising. From what I heard, there was, you know, according to certain sources, which is published in some magazines, there was division within the Politburo of the Communist Party. And the president Hu decided to handle this matter very carefully. He said that he must, first of all, try to find out whether there is any linkage between this movement and certain foreign hostile powers. And then he would only target those who have, you know, this connection. But, you know, up to now, as I've said, people continue to put their names on it. It become sort of a movement on the internet. Now, at the same time, I'll let you know what happened in China. In December, a certain document known as document number 24 of the propaganda department was issued, calling for a tightening up control over, you know, mass media, over propaganda, especially with the aim of imposing the doctrine of anti-Westernization and mainly anti-Westernization. And there is also a number two document issued by the Politburo of the central government calling up again for preventive measures to be put in place to ensure that that there wouldn't be pervasive infiltration into China by foreign hostile powers. Now, they set up a number of indicators showing what are foreign hostile powers. It was reportedly said that these foreign hostile powers include not only government, but also, you know, the government agencies, include NGOs, include politicians, outspoken politicians, who advocated, you know, an end to one-party dictatorship in China, who advocate multi-party politics in China, and then that sort of thing, you know, calling for immediate action in China to end, you know, this sort of one-party dictatorship. Although, you know, this is only, you know, sort of propaganda campaign in a peaceful manner, they still treat it as sort of infiltration of political influence into China. Now, the charter, I've said, is now connected, has now proliferated into about 300,000 websites in China, is now vigorously debated on blogs, on certain, you know, on QQ, which is a popular Chinese message service. Now, what is the next step that China, that the Chinese government is going to do to stop it? Is the question that many people would like to know, particularly after the release of that two policy documents. Now, we all know that this year is a very sensitive year. Many leaders in Beijing has become paranoid about any, you know, threat to social stability. Of course, you all know that this is the 90th anniversary of June 4th movement, the 20th anniversary of the June 4th massacre, the 50th anniversary of the suppression of the Tibet uprising, leading to the exile of the Dalai Lama, etc. And also, you know, the Tibet suppression also happened 10 years ago, leading to the massacre of thousands of people in Tibet. And also, this is also the 60th anniversary of the founding of the nation. Actually, there are many voices calling for change. Of course, you know, the most comprehensive call is spelled out in this charter. There are other calls, such as from the famous reporter Tai Ching, calling for the setting up of a truth council to investigate, to undertake a full factual investigation into the June 4th massacre, for the purpose of leading to a reconciliation between the government and the people. And there are also calls from representatives in various levels of the National People's Congress and the Consultative Councils for special pardon to be given to political dissidents in commemoration of the 60th anniversary of the founding of the nation. Now, this is, of course, a long tradition of China where special amnesty is granted in special on special occasions. Now, apart from that, we all know that China is being confronted with financial, you know, economic recession as a result of the global financial crisis. Unemployment rate is escalating, and then it's a lot of difficulty of keeping the GDP growth at above 8%, and then the number of what they call mass incidents, namely, you know, open protest in the country, has also kept on escalating. Now, in 1999, the figure is 32,000 per annum. When you talk about mass incident, it means, you know, public activities participated by over 100 people. You know, protesting or challenging the government. 2003 is 58,000. 2004, 74,000. 2005, 85,000 per year. Now, all these are official statistics. And since then, there was no further release of public figures. And according to an intelligent estimation, in 2007, the figure has risen to 125,000. So it's quite a significant increase. And so the leaders felt that the security or the of the country, or social stability, in other words, are really under enormous threat, and they feel very, very insecure. And against that background, there is uprise of movements, spontaneous movements in the communities, you know, in response to various issues affecting livelihood of the people, including, you know, the contaminated milk powder issue, leading to, you know, a lot of victims trying to protest, trying to take the government officials responsible, you know, environmental pollution, healthcare problem, you know, for instance, the spread of AIDS. And Wu Jia was one of the prominent activists who tried to, you know, work on the AIDS patients and trying to inform the community about the gravity of the situation. And we all know that he's now in jail. And also, a number of industrial accidents, particularly coal mine, you know, accidents. Now, all these unfortunate events had led to people to become aware that they have to fight for their own rights. And hence, there's the uprise of the defenders movement. And there is, in the last few years, also the emergence of a prominent group of lawyers with whom, you know, our group has particular concern. You know, they are human rights lawyers. They are not organized, but they are connected with one another. They are connected with one another. They are concerned with one another. They render support to one another. Now, they're taking up human rights cases, they're taking up public interest cases, and they try to challenge the government to make sure that officials must respect the law. And they, you know, and they are courageous enough to take up many most sensitive cases and to challenge the government, you know, from the lowest court to the highest courts. Now, so it's really difficult for me to tell what is going to happen, you know, in the years to come with this, you know, campaign that is still moving, that is still, you know, getting momentum. But there's something that I can certainly share with you. Is my observation, is my view on the significance of this Charter 08 movement. First of all, now notwithstanding, you know, all the efforts of the government or its agents trying to subdue, trying to intimidate intellectuals, trying to tame them, trying to, you know, make them subservient to the state, and notwithstanding, you know, a lot of policies trying to corrupt and deprive these intellectuals. But yet, today, we have seen that a group of these people, not an insignificant number of intellectuals, willing to stand up just to show that they are not willing to conform. Okay? They are not prepared to subdue, and they would speak their heart, their conscience, for the interest and the welfare of the whole nation. I think symbolically, that is very important. People speaking the conscience of the nation without fear. You know, they got the courage to maintain their non-conformity with the authority. This is point one. Point two, I think the strength of the Charter lies in its modesty, in its rationality, and in its openness. People put the names on it openly. They are not doing any underground activities. Okay, they do it saying that they are doing their job as a citizen. Okay, they are entitled to do it. They are not afraid of the consequence. And some writers and academics who was intimidated by the secret police, threatening that they may be removed from their post, they may be banned from further publishing, or even they may be detained. The answer, invariably, from these intellectuals who subscribe to the Charter, is that I will not withdraw my name. We have not broken any law. We are entitled to say what we believe in. And we are saying this because it is in the interest of the nation, and we are just upholding values which our nation has at one time, at least, you know, when joining the UNO, when signing on the IPCCR, have, you know, endorsed. So this is important. So in the words of Havel, you know, the former Czech president, who is also one of the initiators of the Charter 77 movement in Czechoslovakia, you know, a few decades ago, he recently gave an award to three of the initiators of the Charter 08. Now, he said, and in fact, you know, this movement, the Charter 08 movement, is somehow modeled, not only inspired, they're modeled on this Charter 77 Czech movement. Now, in his words, Havel's words, this is a loose, informal, and open association united by the will to strive individually and collectively for the respect for human and civil rights in our country and throughout the world. So this is a movement. This is not an organization. There's no breach of any law. you know, in respect of organization. So this is an awareness movement, a civil rights awareness movement, connected by this informal, open-ended association. And one other point is that, as said by many observers, the movement is a testament to the power of the Internet. I think this point is too obvious. There is at present, according to official figures, at least 50,000 Internet police in mainland China. But I believe there is much more than that. It's at least 3 to 4 times Internet police, you know, of 50,000, working full-time, trying to block the flow of information. But I do believe that, you know, hundreds of thousands of Internet police can hardly stop the desire and determination of the Chinese people trying to receive and impart information. You know, we are talking about, you know, 1.4 billion people. And up to now, the Internet population has already exceeded 300 million people. And lastly, the lawyers are important. They will play an important role in this movement because, obviously, they are calling for a constitutional democracy and a right-based society. And so the roles of lawyers will be very important. Now, to draw it close to my talk, I would like to read you a poem written by Qiu Yuxiao. The title of this poetry is Mineshaft, Our Black Home. Now, in our effort to stand, our head hits the ceiling and our speed crowns blown with blood. In our effort to survive, our hands become feet and drag us along the ground. Now, in the human communities of this earth, our distant customs have long bathed in the light of freedom, while spring rains have begun to shower the fields of our neighbors and near kinsmen. Let us praise our heavy pickaxes. Let us raise our heavy pickaxes and smash through the thick wall of despair, open the great bridge and let in clear water to cleanse our black home, break the thick partition, and let our heartfelt wails resound to heaven. We want a new home. With these words, I conclude. Thank you.
Albert has kindly agreed to take some questions. It's the usual procedure. If you'd like to identify yourself, and we'll zap along. Tom.
Well, Mr. Ho, Tom Holland from the South China Morning Post. A question purely from personal interest. Is there any clear sense of the attitude of the Charter 08 signatories towards foreign support, towards foreign government statements on the Charter 08? And is there any sense that active campaigning by foreign organizations, by foreign government, could in some ways play into the hands of those in the Chinese government that would want to suppress this movement because it so easily labels Charter 08 as the tool, as you say, of foreign hostile power?
Thank you, Tom, for your question. I think, obviously, the propaganda department and the Public Security Bureau would like to find a culprit in the movement, a culprit which belongs to a foreign hostile power. But up to now, it seems that they have not been able to do it. And I believe the reason why, you know, all the signatories and all and promoters of the Charter 08 can be so relaxed, in a sense, you know, that they come out openly, speak out freely, because they know, especially, you know, the prime movers, they know that it is not prompted, this is not connected to any foreign government. They are doing it, you know, autonomously and spontaneously by their own. They have been in preparation for this document for a few months among the intellectuals. And they must have a lot of support, but yet they keep it among themselves. So So the short answer to the question is, I don't think there's any black hand, you know, from foreign government or foreign powers. And of course, it's possible that they may be framed. Okay, they may be framed. Some people may be framed. But the fact that I've seen, you know, Mo Xiaoping, you know, one of the leading human rights lawyers, going to Czech Republic to receive the award from Mr. Havel, shows that he's not afraid of it, and shows that there's nothing to hide. So up to now, you know, I'm still confident that that this movement is entirely spontaneous, autonomous, you know, is initiated within the country, within the mainland, and that any subsequent support given to it are doing it, you know, by foreign people, are doing it on their own, you know, because of their support to the principles and the spirit enshrined in the document.
But there's no feeling that you know, for among the signatories that they wish perhaps that foreigners should shut up because they're doing more harm than good by supporting the movement.
Well, I don't really think that people should be shy from giving support to it. And after all, China knows that she's not living in isolation. You know, she is now claiming to be one of the, you know, uprising, you know, also in a peaceful manner, power in the world. You know, not only economically is China connected to the world, but she is also, you know, and signatories to many international covenants, you know, covering not only economic and financial matters, you know, also in social and political matters. You know, they are putting a lot of effort to enter into what they call dialogues with human rights organizations all over the world. Although, you know, they spoke their own language, you know, the best thing about it is that they are trying to hide up a lot of abuses in China, a lot of. So for instance, you know, in the hearing of the report from the Chinese delegation on the torture convention, and recently, you know, and also on some other conventions concerning human rights, the Chinese delegation has been very skillful in trying to avoid issues, and they are very skillful in trying to whitewash the situation in China. But at least by doing that, they are pretending to show to the world that they share the same value, isn't it? Otherwise, there wouldn't be a common platform for them to enter into dialogue. So in a way, you know, it shows that just by saying that this is Western values and it is going to be poisonous to China, it is itself totally unsustainable. Because even now, China accepts that there are certain values that is universal. And Wen Jiabao, you know, the premier, had mentioned these terms a number of times when he's giving speeches, you know, during his visit to the Western countries. Although, you know, he has now recently, you know, stopped using these words when she's back to the country. But at least, you know, it's something, it shows that China does accept universal value, the concept of universal value. And so my opinion is that all those people, you know, within and outside China, if you think that you should support Charter 08, by all means, speak up freely, without reserve, showing your concern and support. This would be enormous encouragement to the people in China.
Fred Armentrout, a freelance. I'm curious, Mr. Ho, on the Chinese government side, what do you think accounts for their apparent restraint? For instance, you point out they didn't arrest the intellectuals, they harassed them, which by their standards is fairly mild. Do you see this as a form of progress, or do you see this as a temporary tactic for some purpose?
Yes and no. In a way, the Chinese government is now more careful and skillful in handling this matter. It shows that the initiators of Charter 08 have been very clever they know that there is certain limit which they should not go beyond. Okay, so there is in fact no timetable for change, for particular radical change in China. There is no action plan for the people to take the matter to a particular, to a particular authority. There is particularly no incitement to the people, to come together on a particular date, to challenge the government. No call for an immediate end to one party dictatorship. So the Charter 08 objectives allow room for incremental change in China. And not to mention that, the basic spirit of the document is consistent with the ICCPR and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, to which China endorses. So it's very clever. They have exercised a lot of self-restraint. And so the CCP knows that they cannot, simply naked power to suppress these people. Okay, it's going to, and it's not going to, it's not going to hurt the image of the government, but it would isolate the party from many people, precisely because the Charter does articulate the thinking of many people. Is now, the effect and the impact is now spreading to the grassroots people, to the intelligentsia, and as well as to people within the parties. So they have to figure out how to deal with it. So that's why there is the issuance of two documents. One is try to control propaganda, try to, initiate an anti-Westernization campaign, okay, and try to reiterate certain values which they think would be particularly good for China, okay? So they may try to, maybe up nationalism, patriotism is a banner that they would use to try to indoctrinate the people, to try to counter, the impact of the Charter 08. At the same time, they will be very careful to try to find and try to locate whether or not there is people, who can be proven, or at least who can be branded as connected with foreign hostile powers. So they have to, this time they do it with a lot of self-restraint. Now, I think in the times to come, there will be a lot of this sort of dedicated interaction between those who are in power and those who are powerless, except that they still have the power to speak out. So in other way, the Chinese government is also very cautious, very skillful. Of course, they are not ready. They are, of course, not ready to give up power and then accept the blueprint that's set out in the Charter. But we should never forget that people within the party may have different views, and we cannot take that all people are thinking identically like what the president, the premier, is thinking. So I think the effect is coming out gradually, and to us, I think time is running in our favor if there is no immediate suppression of the movement.
Phelim Kine from Human Rights Watch. Albert, I'm interested in your views on Liu Xiaobo's role in this. It was significant that he was previously seen as fairly untouchable, and it's significant that he was rounded up, and he has sort of carried the burden of the Charter 08 so far. What do you see in terms of how long the Chinese authorities are going to see fit to hold him? You mentioned residential surveillance and 6 months, but obviously the Chinese government has already violated the terms of residential surveillance by holding him outside his home. So yes, what's going to happen to Liu Xiaobo? Thank you.
Well, we all know that he's now put in incommunicado in a rural area in Beijing. He's more or less in prison, actually, although not formally in a prison. But he is now put under house arrest outside his home. I think many people said that this is an act to kill a chicken to scare the monkeys. But I don't think it has the effect of scaring all the other people who have put their names on the charter. You know, people like Xu Youyu, Zheng Enchong, and many other people, and Zhang Zhuhua, they have all been taken out and intimidated and interrogated for a long time. You know, pressing them to withdraw, as simple as withdrawing the names from the charter. But they say unequivocally and in strong term that they will not do it. So I don't think it has the scaring effect, but still they have to do something to show their strong, you know, disapproval of the document. So maybe this is an act symbolic of the strong disapproval of the CCP of this movement. Now, we all know that there has been, you know, campaign, you know, calling for the immediate release of Liu Xiaobo. And we all hope that he will be released as soon as, you know, this residential, you know, as soon as possible, at least not longer than 6 months. But, you know, God knows, you know, what is going to happen. But it seems that instead of trying to penalize these people by jailing them, putting them into prison, or trying to harass their family members, etc., it seems that the party is focusing on taking tougher measure to start another ideological campaign. On one hand, they try to control the flow of information. They try to monitor the internet in a more effective way, and they will try to, you know, brainwash the people, the younger generations, the party graduates, and the intellectuals. It's not easy, but they see it as the way to counter the movement instead of making a few more martyrs, you know, or a few more heroes by putting this, you know, the prime movers into prison. The simple reason is that the charter is effective. It truly articulates the thinking of the people. So you can't now rip out the effect of the charter once it is released, because it has already been spread out through, you know, to the whole countries through 300,000 websites. So I think that is the best response I can give to your question. I don't know really what is going to happen. I hope he will soon be released.
Okay. Two more. I think we've got time for two or three. Francis Moriarty first.
Francis Moriarty, RTHK. Albert, do you see any implication in this whole Charter 08 affair and how the government is handling it for the Hong Kong and Macau SARs?
Sorry.
Did you see any implications in this Charter 08 movement and the government's handling of it that has any effect or any possible implications for Hong Kong and Macau SARs?
Of course, you know, they are always very apprehensive of the political influence emanated from Hong Kong into the mainland. But there is nothing much they can do about it, except they would do all the best they can in Hong Kong, try to oust us from public office. They try to support the pro-Beijing political parties, and they wait for time, you know, a lot of patience, hoping that they will one day win the election, you know, have a landslide victory of the local elections, and oust all the outspoken politicians, pro-democracy politicians from public offices. Now, they have spent a lot of course, resources mounting propaganda in Hong Kong. But, you know, Hong Kong is such an open society. You know, people are used to listen to different views, and people are, in general, well-informed. So it's not much they can do. Recently, we all know that they have been trying their very best to try to put dissidents into exile. You know, prominent lawyers like Zheng Enchong and Gao Zhixing, you know, have been subjected to a lot of pressure, because the government want them to go into exile, but they refuse to do it. They know that they would lose their influence once they left the mainland. But their family members have left. They have, you know, fled China, you know, surprisingly. They seem to be suggesting that all these rescue operations have been connected to activists in Hong Kong. That is what I heard. But, you know, even if that is the situation, so what? You know, if you can get out the people who have breached the law, then and if within their jurisdiction, they can exercise their power, and that's it. In Hong Kong, I would say that the Charter 08 movement would continue to receive a lot of support locally, and there are more and more politicians, more and more activists putting their names onto it. There would be more open forums, and there would even be open signature campaign in Hong Kong. But China has already accepted that Hong Kong is special, you know, a place where you can have the candlelight vigil, you know, where tens of thousands of people attended every year. So that is Hong Kong. So I don't think there would be any change of policy or strategy to Hong Kong as a consequence of the Charter 08 movement. And they would just go along with their ongoing policy, you know, to support the pro-Beijing factions in Hong Kong and trying to gain control and influence and control by soft power.
Okay, we're running out of time here, but one last question. Gentleman over here.
I'm sorry.
In the white shirt.
Oh, doesn't matter. Maybe I answer both. I answer both.
Please. Okay. Answer both. We'll make them brief questions. Okay. Appreciate that.
Okay. Hi, Edith Terry. I just wanted to rephrase Francis's question.
Yes.
You've talked about the views of Beijing towards Hong Kong coming out of Charter 2008. What's the impact on people in Hong Kong? Specifically, is there any thought of coming up with a Hong Kong version of this charter?
Oh, I see. Good.
Perhaps to accelerate democratic reforms in Hong Kong.
Okay, my name is Jess Nielsen. I'm with the Jutland Post, a Danish newspaper. Can you just elaborate a little bit, perhaps, about this movement that you keep talking about? It seems to me there isn't much of a movement when a charter that's been online for coming up to 4 months now, 5 months, whatever, has gotten several thousand signatures, where a piece of popular culture can circulate the internet and gather tens of thousands of comments in the span of a few days. Can you just explain perhaps why you think it's a movement?
Okay. Now, to answer the second question first, I think Hong Kong needs time to warm up. Okay. There's just too many information, too much information, you know, in Hong Kong. But the politicians and activists are becoming more and more concerned about the movement. And in fact, within our party, we have already held seminars, and there are many people, more and more party members, you know, from our party, becoming interested, and there would be further networking should there be a further campaign on this matter in Hong Kong, including a signature campaign. But there's a lot of education work to be done. It's not, you know, that's not, it did not occupy head news in the TV or the newspaper. There's a fact. But I think it's going to have a long-term effect. It's going to have a long-term effect. There would be a warm-up period, as I've said. And people like us would know that this movement is important, is crucial, not only for China, but also for Hong Kong. So that's come to my response to the second question. Now, as a veteran democratic fighter in Hong Kong, all the time I know that the political future of Hong Kong is inevitably tied to China. There wouldn't be democracy in Hong Kong unless the Chinese government, the Chinese leaders have a paradigm change in thinking and accept democracy as the final goal for political development in China. One day, the Chinese leaders still totally, disbelieve in constitutional democracy and liberty of the people and multi-party, politics. There's no way that they will allow Hong Kong to be run by a truly democratic system where there is rotation of powers between different political parties. So knowing that, we all feel that this Charter 08 movement has shed light on the future of our country. It shows that, the hearts of the people have not died, and there are still people who will seize every opportunity to fight for more openness. And this time, having learned in a hard way from the 1989 students and movement and the subsequent massacre, people know that they have to do it very systematically. They know that the movement has to be sustainable, it has to be rational, it has to be peaceful. And so this time, all the Charter 08 movement is carefully thought out. And the movers know that it has to be sustainable. Okay, so that's why they exercise a lot of self-restraint when they are, adopting, when they are drafting the Charter. So in short, the Charter 08 is really, as I've said, shedding light on the future. As to how long would be the tunnel, is the tunnel ahead of us? I don't know. But at least we know that we are fighting, we are moving towards the right direction. There is certain light coming out from the opening, from the end of the tunnel. And, there are already, many people have spoken on the situation that although China feels that she's a superpower, but it's fragile. It's a fragile superpower. There's so much domestic unrest. There is so much, threat within the country that their leaders can hardly feel comfortable even allowing a few intellectuals to speak out. So you see how delicate, how subtle is the situation? Nobody will ever know what is going to happen because China is now having a closed system. There is no complete free flow of information, and people may be hiding their views. People who are having power within the hierarchies may be hiding their views. Maybe when the right time comes, they will stand up and then advocate certain interest, advocate fundamental change to the system and to the country. So the hope is always there. So when people have the values, when the people have the courage, when they speak up, and not only by themselves, but followed by so many people, it shows that the Chinese people are now willing, prepare, and fighting for the chance to stand up and build the truly People's Republic and not the Communist Party's Republic of China.
Well, Albert Ho, thank you very much indeed. I'd like to apologize on behalf of the board that we haven't managed to get the Chinese Foreign Ministry to protest against your speech, although I'm sure if they were here, they would have found good reason to do so. And in the traditional and time-honored way of the FCC, I'd like to present you with a small memento. Oh,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Oh.
Thank you for all your patience.
Thanks for coming. Oh, yeah. We need a photo.
That's good. I'll make it.